Do you see the deals on these brands?
Of course you can't. This is a podcast.
But when you go to Ross this spring, you'll see brands you know at prices you love. We're talking all the shoes, hues, and oohs at 20 to 60% off department store prices. Go see the savings at Ross.
You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in-line and online. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/truecrime.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 16 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, impossible suspect, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you today?
Hey, Mike, I'm good, man. Happy Cinco de Mayo.
Cinco de Mayo, we're taping on.
That's right.
We got to start out with some Patreon shout outs. Got some new supporters. We always love that. So, Jason Stroud, Selena Ginger, Kate Melb, Melanie Link, Joe DeVee, loving that name, man, and Allie. So thank you all so much, and thanks to everyone that continues to support us. Some of you have been with us from the beginning. It really means a lot. It helps us to pay bills, and it helps us to, you know, keep producing content. So
my legal fees.
And Gibby's retainer for the numerous investigations that he's involved in. I mean, there's depositions. He has to fly to the Pacific Northwest. He's got a lot going on.
I'm all over the place, man.
So I got to give a special shout out to my man, Nate Humbrecht. And Nate messaged me on Facebook a while back, and he said, you know, I really like this case of the Texarkana Phantom Killer. And I said, yeah, you know, that's a really good one. And he said, you should do it. And I said, okay, we will. We'll take a look at it. I mean, I had known of the case. A lot of people know of the case. And so when Nate saw that we were doing it, he reached out to me and said, oh, you know, thanks a lot. So for all the friends of Nate's that are listening to this episode, always believe what Nate says because it's 100% true.
Yeah, and he didn't send us a $50 check in the mail to say this.
No, we're saying this, you know, on our own.
That's right.
All right, so Unsolved, we already talked about it. We're talking about the Texarkana Phantom Killer, also known as the Moonlight Murders, Texarkana Moonlight Murders. You'll see that. The Phantom Slayer. Again, give you how many times we talk about this. You have to have at least three or four nicknames.
Oh, absolutely. To be big time.
So I just got to start out with a clip.
He wore a white hood and was known only as the Phantom Killer. World War II had just ended. In Texarkana, Arkansas, boys had come home to their families. Husbands reunited with their wives. It was a happy, peaceful time. Until the Phantom Killer struck. For 4 months, he held an entire city in the icy grip of terror.
So I think that's the perfect way to start the show, man.
Something about a burlap mask with two little slits in it. Scary shit.
Oh, it is scary. Dude, we put that picture up, and obviously that was, you know, from the trailer from the original movie.
Right.
The town that dreaded sundown. But we put one of the pictures from the movie up on the Facebook, and people are like, holy shit, that's, you know, that's,
I don't know, something about that is scary, man.
Oh, it is.
You know?
It is. I mean, it's got some Zodiac qualities to it. Now, Zodiac didn't wear a burlap, but he had a mask, he had the slits, and
I'd rather face a clown than that.
There's just something about the masked man.
Right. But it's a creepy mask though.
Oh yeah.
You know? It's not like a Jason mask or a
Michael Myers. Michael Myers is not a creepy mask.
Not like the something about the burlap sack, man. That's just a creepy little thing with two little slits cut out for the eyes.
I'll give you that. If you see the pictures from the movie, and obviously that's a movie, but I mean that is the description. It is creepy. I'm going with Phantom Killer. I like the Texarkana Phantom Killer. We may interchange it up, Moonlight Murders, whatever you want to call it.
The funny thing about the Moonlight Murders, right, when you read a lot about the case, they talk about that when all these occurred, there wasn't a full moon. There never was a full moon out.
So why do they call it the Moonlight Murders?
Yeah, you know.
It's catchy.
I think it ties into more of the Lover Lane, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That we're going to talk about.
Catchy title.
Catchy title.
So we're talking about an unidentified perpetrator, the Texarkana Phantom Killer. And, you know, he committed a number of murders and assaults, obviously in Texarkana. And this is made up of Miller County, Arkansas, and Bowie County, Texas, right? So these are right across the state lines, you know, butting up against each other. And now this is an old case, Gibbs. I mean, we're talking about 1946. And a lot of times people would say, it's too old. But there is a ton of interest in this case.
Oh, I've never seen, as far as an unsolved one that we've done, and even solves that we've done, the initial buzz just in one day
on social media
is incredible.
It was a lot. I was really shocked. A lot of people were saying either, you know, I love that case, I'm glad you're covering it. But there was also a lot of people that said that they really didn't know much about that case and it sounded very interesting. And of course the picture scared the bejeebies out of them.
Yeah, the picture definitely helped.
And again, we talked about the fact that they've made a couple of different movies. They made the first one back in the 70s, and then I think they made a remake. Now, Gibbs, you know what was crazy about this one is how much information is out there.
Oh, I mean, for an unsolved, it is crazy amount.
Yeah, so I think when we got into it, it didn't take very long to realize that this is probably going to be a two-parter.
Right.
Just because of there's just a vast amount of information to cover.
In all honesty, you could probably turn this into a three-parter just because all the rabbit holes and theories and what ifs and rumors and, I mean, but I think, I don't know if you could ever get everything in, and I think there's still going to be people that say, but you didn't talk about that, or you forgot about this.
Well, we always have that, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think we're due, you know, a good two-parter on this one, yeah. I think. You're like it.
Well, we always have that. We always have the people that know a lot about a certain case and they're saying, oh, why didn't you talk about X? And, you know, we pick and choose and maybe we didn't see that, or I mean, maybe we made a conscious decision because of time.
Right.
All right. So we got to jump right into the victims. And we're talking about February 22nd, 1946, close to midnight. Right? Ooh, this is where I get my spooky.
Partial moon out.
Partial moon. So we have two victims, right, in this first piece. It's Jimmy Hollis. He's 25 years old. And Mary Jean Larry, she's 19. Now, parked on a secluded part of Richmond Road, which is just outside Texarkana. And this is what people described as the local Lover's Lane. And a man with a flashlight comes up to the car. He points it right in Jimmy's eyes. And again, this is where you get the similarities to Zodiac, right? very similar to some of the early murders of the Zodiac. Couples, secluded, pull up in a car. So both Jimmy and Mary, they're forced out of the car. And again, you talked about it, Gibbs. This man is wearing and has his face hidden by this burlap sack that has two slits for the eyes. It's a scary thought. Now, the man tells Hollis, Jimmy Hollis, to take his pants off. Right? Normally not a good first thing to hear.
Mm-mm.
But he's told that if you comply, you won't be hurt. But that was a lie. Because as soon as he takes his pants off, he gets pistol whipped by the man in the burlap sack. And Jimmy's skull is cracked in two places. So while this is all taking place, Gibbs, Mary Jean Larry is pleading with this guy. You know, she's basically saying, you know, Jimmy doesn't have any money. You know, we have nothing to give you. What do you want? The man with the mask tells her she's lying and that she had a purse. How does he know that?
Well, he probably saw it as he got up to the close to the car.
And that makes sense. Because for some reason in my mind, I was thinking, you know, how did he know that she had a purse? Had he followed them from some other location? And
well, that could happen too, right? We don't know.
Yeah, but
that's the unknown.
I mean, I think what you're saying is probably the most likely explanation. He was up close to the car as he was pointing the gun and shining the light in, you know, Jimmy's face. I assume the flashlight, he could have easily spotted the purse. But my mind went somewhere else to start with. Now, Mary Jean tells him that she doesn't have a purse. And for that, she gets knocked to the ground. And she would later say that it felt like she got smacked with a pipe.
Well, you know what?
That's how bad.
And you think about back in the day, those flashlights, that would be like getting hit with a pipe.
So she's ordered to get up, and the guy tells her to take off running. And she ends up running towards this ditch, and it's like he's trying to help her,
yeah,
guide her.
Don't go that way.
Yeah.
Don't go that way.
Don't go there. That's a ditch. He tells her to run up this way to the road. So, I mean, that's very interesting to me. Now, she states later that while she's doing this running, She's hearing the whole time Jimmy groaning and that he's just being beaten. And she can hear this as she's trying to run away.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure she's hearing him kicking him and just wailing on the guy.
Now, she's in high heels, so that she's not, you know, wearing her Nikes.
Well, 1946, I don't think they had Nikes, but...
But it had to have been tough.
Right.
And then for some reason, the guy starts running after her. So riddle me that. At first, it's almost like he's telling her how to get away. He's letting her go. And don't go that way because you're going to run and fall in a ditch. Run this way to safety. Now he's going to take off and chase her?
Yeah, it sounds like it's kind of like a game.
Like a cat and mouse type game.
Yeah.
So she sees a car parked up the street and she's running towards that car. She looks inside real quick when she gets to the car. There's no one in it. She again begins to take off running, but she's caught by her attacker. And the man asks something very strange to me.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "Why are you running?"
Yeah. So the weird thing is, I mean, just minutes ago, right? He instructed her to run down the street. He told her, don't run towards that, run towards this.
Right. And that's where it's really, like you said,
it's a game.
It is a game. He's playing a game with her because he says that she's a liar. You know, like you said, she's pleading with him, saying, "Wait, you just told me to take off running." He's calling her a liar, and now he's saying he's going to kill her. He sexually assaults Mary, and he does it with the barrel of the gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of sick.
It is
any
sick.
Any sexual assault, whatever, it's sick.
No doubt about it.
To me, it's more like a power thing.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
What does that mean that he used that particular object? That is, to me, it's saying, I'm lording over you. I'm lording this power that I have with this gun over you.
Yeah. But, I mean, she manages to get up, and she just tells him, go ahead and kill me. Just kill me. And she's somehow able to get free, and she just books it down. Finally, I guess she figures out how to run in her high heels.
Or she ditches him.
And she just goes.
And the whole time she thinks she's being chased.
Yeah, she's
assuming.
He's right on her heels, right? So she's running as fast as she can.
But she makes it to a house. And she's screaming and she's banging on the door. A car even passes. Now, again, this is after midnight in the 40s. It's not like today. You're not going to have cars running all over the place at past midnight. But the car doesn't stop for her. You know, even she's trying to flag it down. At the same time, she's banging on this door. She's trying to get these people to open up and help her. Ultimately, she has to run all the way to the back of the house. And that banging on the back, she's able to wake up the owners of the house. They call police. So there's four officers, Gibbs, that eventually arrive at the scene. But the attacker has already driven off, right?
Yeah.
By the time they get there, he's no longer there.
He's gone, but they're checking out the site.
And one of the officers is Bowie County Sheriff W.H. Bill Presley. And he's kind of famous. I mean, he's in the movie, right? He's like a central character in that first movie. So they end up finding Jimmy's pants that, you know, he had been ordered to take off about 100 yards away from where the attack happened. So the great news in this situation is that both of the victims survived. You know, Mary is taken to the hospital. She's got some minor cuts and she did have to have some stitches for some of her head wounds, but really all in all, I mean, besides being sexually assaulted, which is horrible, but she survived, had relatively minor wounds to her extremities. Let's say that.
Yes.
Psychologically, we're talking a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
For Jimmy, he took a much worse beating.
He did.
He's in the hospital for, you know, several days. He ends up with 3 separate skull fractures.
And I think they think that it could have went worse. But I think when she ran the first time, she passed a car. First time, second time, she passed a car that had the that wouldn't stop for her. And I think when those headlights went on down the road, it probably scared the Phantom off. And I most likely stopped the beating of Jimmy. Because I think Jimmy talks about, you know, he felt that he was pretty close to death.
I have to imagine. Is that one of the reasons why the Phantom doesn't chase after Mary that second time?
Absolutely. I believe that's what happened because, you know, he's got one person down on the ground that he probably thought he was going to come back to after he took care of the next step with Mary. But then here comes some headlights. He gets out. You know, it's time for me to go. He's not going to. That's why he didn't pursue her. That's why it was so easy for her to get up and go.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's maybe what saved Jimmy's life as well.
Absolutely. I think that's true.
Because, you know, and now Mary doesn't find this out till later. But it comes out that Jimmy through all his injuries, he's able to make it to the road, and he ends up flagging down a car. They're able to get to a phone and contact an ambulance. So Mary would tell the officers that she believed that her attacker was black and that she did not know who he was. The officers didn't believe her about this. They really thought that for some reason, Gibbs, she knew who their attacker was, to the point where they actually tried to get her, they tried to coerce her into saying that she knew who it was. So her description was a man with a white mask over his head, cut out places for the eyes and mouth. Now, Jimmy was blinded almost from the get-go, so I don't think he was able to see as well as Mary was. And also, you know, he was beaten pretty quickly, so, and pretty severely. But he thought, he didn't think it was a black guy. He had a description of what he thought was a white male with a dark tan. Now, they both agreed on this guy's height, and they thought he was about 6 feet tall.
And I, like you said, Mike, they agreed on a few things. But one thing that I think they all agreed on a larger scale was that whoever this was, the guy was crazy. I mean, they over the top crazy.
What? And where did they get that from? The cat and mouse game, the weird, some of the things he said, the way he talked.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit
just
of
just the whole vibe that he gave off.
Yeah, a little bit of everything, you know? And like Jimmy said, Jimmy really thought if this guy had enough time, he was going to kill him. To the point, I think he tells the police chief or the officers, right, that if this guy does this again, he is going to kill the next people.
And most likely he would have killed both of them. Would you say that if it would have, if these headlights don't come around the corner or whatever you want to call it and kind of shine on him a little bit, and that probably spooked him. Right. So a lover's lane, secluded,
yep,
dark, these headlights would have been extra bright.
Yeah.
Right. Not like headlights coming down a street today where there's already,
yeah, the street's already lit up.
Yeah, yeah, where it's already lit up. This would have been like a very stark contrast.
It felt like you were in a spotlight.
Yes. Let's jump ahead a month. And we're March 24th. And this two young people are found. This is Sunday. They're found between 8:30 and 9 a.m. by a passing motorist. And this is on another, you know, Bowie County back road, Lover's Lane. The passing motorist sees this parked car, so he stops, you know, to see what's going on. Now, one thing you have to think, I guess I would think, is if it really is a Lover's Lane, it's known for being a Lover's Lane, why is somebody there at 8:30 in the morning?
Yeah. Well, maybe they were there last night, right, and left their, and maybe that's why he, if that was known for an area where a lot of people like to park, and he's driving by, he's like, why is that car still here?
Yeah, something had to have piqued this guy's interest. Yeah.
It's a little different back then than it is today. Today, people don't stop for cars.
I ain't stopping for nobody, Jack.
Especially after listening to all the stuff we talk about.
I'm telling you.
But down back in that time, and down in the South, people were pretty friendly. People were curious. People were willing to help out. So I think they just kind of seen this car on the side of the road, thought something might be wrong, and pulled on over.
People are still curious. I just don't think people are willing to help out nowadays.
Yeah. Nowadays, yeah.
They're curious. Yeah. They like to know what's going on, but they're not going to lift a finger to help you. I say that not because people are bad people. I say it because our world has changed so much. It's too damn dangerous,
yeah,
to help people.
Your best is to call the police and say, right, there's a car on the side of the road, and keep on going.
That's the best way to help out. I mean, you can't give somebody a ride anymore. So when he stops, he finds Richard Griffin, 29 years old. He finds Polly Ann Moore, 17. Both of these people shot in the back of the head would later be determined to be a .32 revolver.
So that's a decent sized caliber.
It's not bad.
Yeah. It's going to do, obviously, it did do the job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely enough to, you know, kill somebody for sure.
Okay.
And, I mean, keep in mind, we're talking about the fact that these, they were shot in the back of the head.
Right. So he pulls over. He realizes that they've been shot in the head. You know, they're in his 1941 olds. But I think that the interesting part is that, you know, when he comes up on Richard, right, Richard's found between the front seat on his knees and with his head resting on his hands kind of crossed. And it's kind of weird. For some reason his pockets are turned out. So is this the guy robbing him for money or making it look like he was robbed?
Well, I think it's one of the two. He's on his knees. Right? He's not sitting on his backside with his legs.
No, I think the Phantom most likely told him, get on your hands and knees.
In the front seat of the car.
Yeah. And he did what he did. He told him to put his head down.
And then when he fell, or maybe he got shot and he fell forward. I don't know.
I think he probably told him put his head down and, you know, until I leave, but then he didn't leave, right? He just shot him.
That makes a lot of sense.
And then we roll over to Polly, right? And you know, when they find Polly, she's in the back seat, and she's found sprawled face down.
So eventually, both bodies, Richard and Polly, they're taken to the funeral home. But what happens, it results in a mistake.
It does, yeah.
Because the bodies are picked up and taken to this funeral home before the police or the coroner or whoever has a chance to do the examination to tell whether or not Polly had been sexually assaulted. Now, we have to talk a little bit about their last known whereabouts prior to the murder. The couple was last seen having dinner with Richard's sister and her boyfriend, and this would have been the night before, about 10 p.m., which, you know, I don't know about you, but for me, that's pretty late.
That is pretty late.
I can't wait till 10 o'clock at night to have dinner. But in addition to that, they were also seen earlier in that day, the day before on Saturday, around 2 p.m., and they were in another cafe. I don't know why these people are in so many different cafes, but
must have been a thing to do back in the day.
I guess they're in a cafe at 2. Maybe they're eating a late lunch. They're in a cafe at 10 eating dinner. That's their last known, you know, sightings, I guess, on Saturday before they would have been murdered sometime Sunday morning, late Saturday. So we do know some of the things that were uncovered during the investigation. So there was a section of the ground about 20 feet from the car that was saturated in dry blood. There was blood spatter in the vehicle. There was congealed blood on the running board, which had flowed all the way through the bottom of the door.
So this kind of goes back to, maybe he was killed in the car because of the splatter, and she was still left on the blanket outside the car where he most likely sexually assaulted and shot her and then moved her to the car.
I like that theory a lot, because how else do you get blood splatter in the car? It almost has to come from the gunshot.
Right.
Now, they found a blanket in the car, and my assumption is this was the blanket.
I would say that is the blanket, because within the blanket is where they found one of the 32 caliber shells.
So this goes back to what we were talking about before, and we're going to see this. This is a signature 32 caliber. Now, they never found a gun at the scene, which to me is not that surprising. You know, I think if you're going to shoot somebody in a secluded area, you're not going to drop the gun Godfather style and just walk away.
Right.
Right. You're going to take the gun with you.
Yeah.
There's no reason not to. But what I think it does do is it completely rules out any type of murder suicide. Right. They know that one didn't shoot the other and then shoot themselves, because obviously you would need to find a gun for that to happen.
Right.
So the one thing that does happen is they bring in the Texas Rangers. They ultimately conclude that the only apparent motive for this was robbery. And I have to assume, Gibbs, that they're doing that based on the fact that Richard's pockets are pulled inside out.
And that because they made the error and let the body go to the morgue, they could never determine if she was sexually assaulted or not.
For sure.
You know, even though we all feel pretty much she was, we don't know that 100% because we don't have that back from the crime lab.
They didn't have a lot of clues here, but they had some stuff. I mean, they had some evidence, and they sent all of that evidence off to labs in Austin. And what they sent was some bloody sand that was found, you know, pretty close to the car. They had the blood-soaked clothing from both Richard and Polly. And basically with the blood, you know, they're trying to determine, is that all their blood, or was it some other third party?
Yeah, because back in the day, they didn't have DNA, but they could determine blood type.
Sure. Yeah. And again, blood type is, you know, back then it was, it couldn't narrow down very much, but obviously they would have known what Polly's blood type was. They would have known what Richard's blood type was. Yeah. So if they found something other than those two,
it could have, yeah, let them know that maybe there truly was somebody else, which I think they should have known that.
Well, but it also could have maybe given them the blood, the third blood type. So while they're waiting for all this lab work and, you know, the blood results and all that, basically, they're doing boots on the ground, old school questioning. And at this point, I mean, pretty early on, Gibbs, they've got 200 different suspects, I think.
Yeah, quite a bit.
They're chasing hundreds of leads and tips. And, you know, at one point, they actually pull in 3 suspects into custody. And this is all based on some bloody clothing. 2, I think, were released pretty early because they had explanations for the, I guess, whatever blood they had on them, whether it was hunting or deer blood or whatever it may have been. But the 3rd suspect was held and grilled for, you know, some time. So on March 27th, the Texarkana Gazette actually puts out an announcement to their readers, and it's talking about how they can help solve these murders, but it's really geared towards, I think, calming the public as well. I mean, it's asking for tips, but, you know, factual tips, but it's also basically saying, you know, don't overreact. Don't say, you know, I think it's my neighbor because this, this, and this, right? Don't just start trying to point out everybody that you think is a killer. You know, let's stick to the facts and let's help solve this case. And then, you know, a few days later, they post a $500 reward to try to get any new information. And I think they have to do this because as it stood at that point in time, really, all the clues that they had led them nowhere so far.
I mean, $500 back in 19, 40s? That's a lot of money.
Oh, it was, sure. Yeah,
that was a lot of money.
No doubt.
It's a lot of money today. It's a lot of money back then, big time.
But again, I mean, on the 30th, they are 6 days from the murder, and they still don't have the results of the blood test back. Let's fast forward another month.
So, yeah, I mean, let's move forward another month, and we're going to go all the way up to April 13th, which happens to be a Saturday night. And we've got Betty Jo Booker. She's about 15, and she was playing her saxophone with her regular, you know, local band. So she's playing with the Red Maries at the VFW club. It was hopping that night. But she didn't get finished until about 1:30 that night. So now we're in this, you know, early Sunday morning. And she was waiting for her friend. Now, remember, this is back in the 40s, right? She's 15.
Well, I was getting ready to say, why is a 15-year-old playing?
But back in that day, man, they were getting married.
Kenny G saxophone until 1:30 in the morning?
Yeah, 1:30 in the morning. Wow. And she's waiting for her friend, Paul Martin. He's 16.
That's the Rhythmaires.
The Rhythmaires?
How do you get Maries out of that?
I don't have very good eyesight. She was waiting for her friend, Paul Martin. He's 16. Martin was in town after moving away 2 years prior. So he's back. He wants to hang out with her. He's going to pick her up. Earlier that day, they were together for a little bit before she had to go up to the VF. W Club, where she was joining her band. So we know that Paul picked her up that night.
Well, and what was said was that she didn't want to go out with him, but it was almost like she felt like she had to because they were old friends.
Yeah, and that he actually came back into town just to hang out with her.
Yeah, I don't think it was something that she really wanted to do.
Yeah.
But I'm still shocked that in 1946... 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds are just able to... I'm shocked about that.
Out and about.
So again, Gibbs, I mean, I think this is very similar to the last one because we're Saturday night into Sunday morning, and it's Sunday, April 14th, that Paul and Betty are found dead in Spring Lake Park, and this is on the Texas side of Texarkana, and... they're found very early, like 6:30 in the morning.
Yeah, by the Weaver family.
Yeah, I don't know what the Weavers are doing out at 6:30, but maybe they're...
might be their farm.
Maybe. But this one's a little different in the aspects of the crime because both of the bodies of Paul and Betty Jo, they're found some distance away from the car. Now, there is a tying fact, and that is that the murder weapon is a .32.
Yeah, then Paul's body, it was found lying on its left side on the road, and blood was found further down on the other side of the road by a fence. So they determined that he was shot 4 times, once through the nose, again through the left fourth rib from behind, which means he most likely was running, right? Clearly.
Yeah.
A third time in the right hand, and then finally through the back of the neck.
So what's strange to me, Gibbs, is that they find Paul's body early on, but it takes them a while to find Betty Jo's body. It's not until 11:30 a.m., so that's quite a difference.
Yeah.
And her body's found a full 2 miles away from where they find Paul. And she's not even found by the same set of people, right? She's found by some searchers. At this point, there's already a search party. And she's found by another family that's part of the search party. My understanding is that the sheriff, having learned early on what happened, he went to the Sunday school that morning and asked for a group to start searching. So they found Betty Jo. She was lying on her back, fully clothed. She'd been shot twice. one shot went through her left rib cage from the front. And then she had another shot that went through her left cheek by her nose. That had to be brutal. I mean, they're all brutal, right? You get shot by a gun, it's brutal. But through the cheek and into your nose?
That hurt.
That's rough. They tied it all back to... Now, I don't know what their ballistics... I don't think they had the same type of ballistics back then as far as, you know, striations on the bullet and all of that. But right. They were able to say it was a .32 Colt pistol. I think that was good enough to say that all these are connected.
So is it the fact that later that they come out with a report that Betty was raped? Maybe that's why her body was found 2 miles away. Maybe the Phantom took her down the road a little bit by that tree, sexually assaulted her, and then finished the job.
Well, it's either that. Well, I mean, I guess I'm thinking, why a full 2 miles? Was there some, did she try to get away? Did the Phantom ultimately catch her? Or was that just the best spot?
It might have been, right? Because where she was found, they know that Paul's car was 3 miles away. And Paul was, you know, about a mile and a half, 2 miles away from where she was located. Why was that location? Was that how she ran that far and that's where he caught up with her? Was that where he picked her up and then took her there?
I was going to say, did he drive her there?
Yeah, I mean, who knows?
We don't know for sure. Now, one thing that police was able to determine, they said that both put up a pretty big time fight. I don't know how that lends into our theory, Gibbs, of did they fight? Did they run? Was he forced to chase them down separately and, you know, shoot Paul as he was running away? And then he turned his attention to go find Betty Jo, but had to catch up with her because she had a head start. Again, it's all speculation.
Yeah, I mean, you could try to play it in your head many different ways.
But I think some of that makes sense.
Yeah.
But like we've said it, but I think, you know, as the investigation is unfolding, I think they're certain, right, based on the evidence and similarities, that all of these are related. As they had done before, they brought in tons of suspects. Now, I don't know where they're getting all these suspects or how they're determining who is a suspect at this point. But like in the case before, I mean, to have 200 suspects within, you know, that short of a time frame, are you just rounding up everybody that is unsavory?
Yeah.
And just talking
it
to them?
It might be. I mean, they got a pretty large task force going here too. I mean, with Texas Rangers and FBI and different state police from both sides. And
Or are they getting just that many tips on suspects that they're able to, I don't know which one it is, but that's a lot of suspects, 200.
I'm thinking back in that time, in that area, pretty rural. I'm just trying to figure out how they have so many suspects with such a low populated area.
They got a lot of unsavory characters, I'm thinking.
I think you're right. I think if you have a burlap sack anywhere near your property, you're a suspect.
So one of the leads that becomes very important is Betty Jo's saxophone. You know, it should have been with her, and it was not found. So they got the make of model of the saxophone. They got the serial number off her specifically, and they started getting that out to all the pawn shops, all the music dealers. In a couple, you know, several different states. So Gibbs, I think investigators are working nonstop on these cases, right? Very high profile. They've got different agencies in, from local police to Texas Rangers and, you know, everybody that they can get. But this was described as one of the most puzzling cases that people had seen in all their years of criminal investigation.
Yeah.
So you had people with 20, 25, 30 years of experience, and they were saying, this is the most puzzling case I've ever seen. Now, the other thing they were talking about was the fact that they did have information that was, so I think the police investigators, they had some information that was very vital to the case that they didn't want leaked out. And they were able to get the local papers to cooperate with them and withhold any sensitive information that the police didn't, because it would compromise their investigation, right? If the public knew some of the things they knew, when and if they got the right suspect, they didn't want that information out there.
And they were working every lead, right? I mean, they took every lead that came in seriously. They were working them all. No matter how small of information it helped them, to nothing, to what they might have thought was substantial information. They worked it all.
And it sounds like night and day. I mean, they were working nonstop. Because of these murders, one thing that happened was that a midnight curfew was put in place by the Texarkana City Council.
Which is smart, right? I mean, if you're still out on the road after midnight anyway, you know.
I would have thought that couples would have self-imposed a curfew on themselves. I'm not going out if I know there's a crazy phantom masked killer that's out looking for couples on Lover's Lane. I think I'll just stay home. So it was said, Gibbs, and I find this kind of, I don't know what the word is, but so they took three rooms of the Bowie County building and they reserved them solely for the use of questioning suspects. And it was said that they were questioning people within a 100-mile radius. And they didn't care if they were men. They didn't care if they were women, black, white, didn't matter. I mean, and I think that goes back to us talking about suspect. They were just questioning, it sounds like, anybody that they thought was suspicious.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the feeling I'm getting.
I'm guessing they just grabbed you and thought if they talked to you that maybe you might have give them some type of information that was useful.
Yeah, so...
Or slip up and say something about yourself.
Right. It sounds like they questioned a lot of people. But really, by April 24th, they had made very little progress. I mean, there was no new developments. You know, the Texas Rangers had to assure the town that they would stay in the city and on this case until it was solved. They even went as far as to bring in an airplane to help with the investigation into other towns, right? So they're following leads and they're talking to suspects in towns far away. They got to jump on an airplane to do that. All right, Gibbs, I think we have to get into talking about some of the rumors that were going around pretty quickly after the second double murder. That there were some rumors being spread that the killer had been caught. There were rumors talking about a local minister had turned in his own son as the killer. Now, police had to come out and say, you know, all of this is false. You know, you can't be listening to every, you know, little thing you hear. But the problem with this was that people really believed like almost everything they heard, whether it made any sense or not.
Right.
It actually started to hinder the investigation because police had to take time out of looking into real suspects and whatever leads they were following to track down these weird rumors.
Yeah.
Just to prove that they weren't real.
They probably had to worry about lynch mobs too for the kid that,
well, I wouldn't doubt it.
You know, that may or may not have been guilty, but because his name was out there, you know, folks could get.
Yeah, because you've talked about it before, but serving up justice, you know, back then, that was a more of a possibility.
That's right. I mean, the rumors were so bad that law enforcement had to go out and make a public announcement and ask everybody to calm down, basically.
Yeah, I mean, there was even a story that the killer had turned himself in to rumors about other multiple murders that hadn't even happened that maybe the police or the news weren't telling you about. The other thing is, and I have to believe that this was the case, that people were using these cases as a vehicle for turning in their neighbors or their enemy, people they had grudges against.
I'd turn you in.
I would turn you in a heartbeat.
I'd probably be found guilty because of the K-bar.
But again, they probably knew these people weren't guilty.
Yeah.
But let's drag their name through the mud.
Yeah, that's all it took, right? I mean,
right. What's that doing? It's causing the police to have to spend precious man hours that they should be spending on.
Because they have to take every lead seriously.
They have to.
Yeah. I mean, even to the point where, you know, the sheriff, right, they reach out to the local newspapers and beg them not to print anything. So they don't want anything to deter them from, you know, the investigations and things like that by having these false rumors out there. So, you know, they ask the newspapers, please don't print things that aren't factual.
Well, and I think they even take it a step further because they say the newspapers will let them know when we have a break in the case and they will print only factual information.
Right.
So trying to tell the public, if you don't hear it from us or through the newspaper, it's not real.
Right. It's not true. Yeah. So they do get a little break, though, don't they?
They do because, you know, we go back to talking about Betty Jo and talking about her playing the saxophone in the band and all of that, and the fact that they never found her saxophone. It was a big deal. And it wasn't until about 6 months later, towards the end of October, that there was these two guys and they discovered her missing saxophone in its black leather case. And what's strange to me, Gibbs, is it was not very far from where her body was found. I mean, I think they said it was 140 steps. That's not very far.
That's not very far at all. It must have been some pretty thick underbrush or something like that that they couldn't locate it. You know, until fall came around, maybe the leaves fell down and they could see it, you know, a little easier.
Had to have been because they had a bunch of searchers out, or was it that they just found her body and then everything kind of stopped? And
right, yeah. Well, that makes sense too.
Maybe that's what it was. All right, Gibbs. So we talked about the missing saxophone, but to do that, we kind of had to jump forward in time, but we wanted to talk about it as it related to the Betty Jo Booker case.
Get it cleared up.
You clear that up. But now we have to kind of chronologically go back in time because it was, again, another month. So let's talk about that before we get into this case. What is the significance of the month after month after month? There's something there. Is it, you know, you and I have talked about cases before where, you know, these killers have urges and they can only hold those urges at bay for so long. Or is there some other significance to this timing of the murders?
Well, it could be, right? It could be a trucker that comes into town once a month. It could be somebody that works on a farm. I mean, who knows? I mean, it could be variables.
Well, could it be lunar cycle? Could it be?
Oh, could be lunar cycle. Very good.
I'm just throwing, you know, a lot of stuff out, but we keep saying, okay, let's fast forward a month. That seems strange to me. It's it's close to being 1 month from the last.
Or like you said in the very beginning of this, is that could it be? Of this statement, could it be the fact that they kill, hold it, and then they just can't do that any longer and they have to strike.
It seems weird now that they can hold it for exactly a month, but now that I say it out loud.
Yeah. You know, but who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. We don't know. Nobody knows.
But is it important? That's a question that I have.
I think if you are investigating this, I mean, you're tracking that. It's a trend. And so you want to try to see why it's a trend and try to work it backwards.
I agree.
I don't know where it's going to get you, but I mean, you try. That's the steps you take.
Well, we know it hasn't gotten them anywhere because the case is unsolved, but right. It's interesting to talk about, and especially, you know, maybe even more so when we get to episode 2, where we're talking about suspects.
Right.
Maybe what they do, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So, but we got to talk about Virgil and Katie Starks. We're on Friday, May 3rd. This is sometime just before 9 p.m. Now, Virgil Starks is 37. He's a farmer. He's a welder. And his wife, Katie, is 36 years old. They live in what was described as back then a modern ranch house.
Pretty big farm, right?
Yeah, because it's a 500-acre farm. And this is just northeast of Texarkana. So around 9 a.m., they're turning on the radio to listen to their favorite show, as you would do back in the day.
Be like back in the day, true crime all the time.
It would be.
Yeah.
But you got to tune in at a certain time.
Back then.
That's the beauty of a podcast.
You get us anytime.
All the time. So Virgil's sitting in his favorite chair. And he's got a heating pad because his back's hurting. And Katie is in her bedroom. And all of a sudden, she hears something coming from the backyard. And it's just seconds later that two shots are fired into the back of Virgil's head through a closed window that's about 3 feet away from him. So the killer is standing at the window. He can see Virgil, see the back of his head.
Yeah, and Katie thinks she hears something, and she just thinks Virgil dropped one of the glasses.
So to her, she didn't hear gunshots. What she heard was more like breaking glass.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the bullets came through the glass.
Right. So she hears that, you know, and she thinks it's just him, you know, that he dropped one of his drinking glasses.
Which is a little strange for me, and I'll tell you why. To me, a gunshot is very distinctive. Now, you may hear something in your house, and it could be a car backfire or a gunshot. You're not sure. But to be that close, like on the range, a gunshot is very distinctive to me.
I mean, in this case, and we're going to talk about it here shortly, it's a .22.
So that makes it a little different.
Yeah.
The report is going to be less, but I've never heard one through glass, so.
Well, that's true too.
Shot through glass.
I don't want to hear one through.
I don't want to hear it at all. So like you said, she thinks maybe Virgil has dropped a glass. She goes in to check on him, and just as she gets through the doorway, Virgil's standing up, and then he just slumps back into his chair, and she sees the blood running, lifts up his head, but he's already dead, and she realizes it very quickly. So Katie immediately runs to the phone to call the police. Now, back in those days, what they had was the old wall crank phone. Right. Got to crank it up. Get somebody on the other line to connect you.
Right.
And she gets through just a couple of cranks before she is shot right in the face from the perpetrator standing in that same window. So the first bullet went through her cheek and exited right behind her left ear. So through the right cheek. Left ear. That's brutal. And then the second one went into her lower jaw, just below the lip, broke her jaw, busted out a bunch of teeth, and ended up lodged under her tongue. I mean, these are brutal shots here to the face. I don't know. It seems brutal to be taking these shots to the face.
Well, talking about her, you know, busting her teeth out. I mean, that's...
Yeah, it just sounds brutal.
It does.
So she falls to her knees. But she doesn't stay there. She's able to get up on her feet. And she's running to get a gun from the living room. But she has so much blood running down her face that she cannot even see. She's almost blinded. There's so much blood. And it's at this point that she can hear the killer ripping through the screen wire on their back porch. And you know it had to be going through her mind that she is about to be killed. But she does something, I don't know, that to me seems very strange, Gibbs.
Yeah, I mean, she's trying to make her way to the front of the house where she can put a note together to leave for whoever finds her.
What's she going to say? Somebody shot my husband and I? Or
maybe she's going to say, I love you, kids.
Did she see the killer? Is she trying to describe? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it does seem strange to me, right? Her first instinct was to get the gun. I think that's a good instinct. And then all of a sudden, that instinct changes to, I need to get to a place where the notes are so I can write something. That I don't get. You know, that's not self-preservation. The gun is. I don't see how leaving a note is part of self-preservation, but I'm not going to dwell on it.
Right. And I think it's short-lived anyway, because, you know, now she's hearing him. He's trying to make any way to get into the house, and she hears him coming through now into the house. So now she's in the mode of, I've got to get out of this house. Right. Her, I don't know if she's calmed down, because you got to imagine, man, your adrenaline is got to be just flying, and maybe you're not thinking very clear.
I would say if you shoot me twice in the face, I don't know what I'm going to be thinking. Right.
So luckily for her, she does start to think clear, and she says, you know, to herself, I got to get out of this place. And she does. She makes her way out, and she runs across the street to her sister's house.
But in doing so, you know, it's said that she literally leaves behind a river of blood. I mean, that's how much blood she's losing. And there's teeth. Her teeth are scattered throughout the house as she's leaving.
Yeah.
I mean, just imagine that scene in your mind.
Pretty gruesome.
It's gruesome. It's horrifying. The fact that she is able to muster the strength.
Well, not even muster the strength to try to run to her sister and brother-in-law's house. But she gets there and they're not even home. So then she has to run about another 50, 60 yards to the neighbor house next to them. And that's where she finally runs into, you know, the people there at that house, and then they call for help.
And they call for help in kind of an unusual way.
Yeah, back in that day, you know, farmers, I think that's how they did it, but go ahead and tell them how.
Well, I'm just wondering if maybe the neighbors were not as well off. Did they not have a phone? Because what he does is shoot his rifle in the air as kind of a, you know, hey, neighbors, come quick type of thing.
Yeah.
And they do.
I mean, that's the old hunting thing. You know, a lot of people would use that hunting too in rural areas. You go hunting, and if you shot once in the air, you needed something, and shot twice in a row, everything was fine. So maybe that's what they were doing back then. But I also thought, when I was researching this, that would have been also a good way to kind of throw off the phantom. Yeah, so if you're shooting off if you hear someone shooting off a rifle, if you're the phantom, I don't think you're going to pursue any further.
No, I'm turning tail and I'm getting the heck out.
So I think for her, it was lucky. It had kind of like a double meaning or a double purpose, right? Not only did they call the neighbor down the road, the come on down, but also, you know, to stop the pursuit of the Phantom.
Yeah, well, for one thing, if I'm the Phantom and I'm carrying a little 22 and somebody's just fired off a big old rifle,
right,
the odds are not in my favor.
Nope. Time to go.
So the neighbors are able to get Kate to the hospital. So at this point, I think, you know, she's going in and out of consciousness. I mean, she's got some pretty brutal wounds, as we said. And, you know, she's slumping forward in the seat and then, you know, kind of waking up a little bit and then going in and out. But at one point, she has one of her teeth, and it's one that has a gold filling in it. And she hands it to the driver and basically saying, here, take my tooth. I mean, this story is just, it's something else to picture in your mind this really happening.
Yeah. Well, maybe she didn't think she was going to make it and wanted him to have it instead of the hospital, the morgue pulling the tooth, or, you know, keeping the tooth in the gold like they did back in the day. Or
I don't know, but this lady's thinking of a lot of things.
Yeah.
She's something else. I'll give her that.
Pretty tough.
And we already know she's lost a ton of blood, right? I mean, literally, they described it as a river of blood going out of the house. But the one thing they were able to do, police were able to question her in the operating room. I mean, so she was, you know, they had stabilized her enough that she was able to talk, I guess.
Even 4 days later, the sheriff comes back and talks to her again. And they just wanted to clear up some rumors because they heard that Virgil stated that he was hearing, you know, a car outside the house for several nights in a row, and that he was kind of fearing for their lives.
So that turned out to be false.
And that turned out to be false.
Yeah, I mean, she was able to quickly say, no, that's not true, or at least from her knowledge, it wasn't true.
Yeah, she didn't know anything about it, so.
So we have to go back, Gibbs, to that night, because it's not too long after all of this happens that the Arkansas State Police is notified. It's a couple of officers. They get a call on their radio, and they rush out to the Starks' home. So there were contradictory reports about what the officers found when they got there. You know, one of the officers said that Virgil was still slumped in the chair, completely soaked in blood, and that the chair had caught fire from his electric heating pad. Described as smoke was filling the room. It was, you know, coming up all around Virgil, coming up between his legs. I mean, you know, emanating from this electric heating pad. Then the sheriff would come out later and say that when the officers got there, they found the chair was on fire, but Virgil had not been burned at all because he was on the floor. So again, not sure why there were
conflicting
statements. You would think that the officers on the scene, their statement would be correct. The sheriff wasn't there. So I don't know why he is saying something different. Now, the one thing that they do pretty quickly is they set up a series of blockades all along the highway. And again, they're calling in the cavalry. They got the FBI. They got the Texas Rangers. They've got the sheriff's office. They've got sheriff's office from other places. I mean, they're literally calling in the cavalry. So it was said that they found three clues at the scene. The first was the caliber of bullets. We've already talked about that, being a 22. The second was a flashlight, and that was found in a hedge underneath that window where the Starks were shot from. And then the last thing they found were bloody prints around the house. So they found shoe prints on the kitchen floor. They found some smudged fingerprints in other places around the house. The sheriff would come out and say that this murder could not be directly linked to the Phantom. I mean, number one, it's a totally different caliber. That doesn't mean it couldn't be the Phantom. It's just not the same caliber that was used in the other killings. But they thought at the time, I believe, that it was possible that it was him. So like they had in the other killings, the police start rounding up suspects for questioning. And they're basically, you know, trying to round up anybody that had been driving near that area, anybody that was in the vicinity. They brought in bloodhounds, and the bloodhounds found a couple of trails, and these trails led to the highway. And it was at that point that they lost the scent.
But they did detain at least 12 suspects, which sounds pretty promising.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think you mentioned it before, right? This has to be somewhat of a rural area. You know, if you're running to your neighbor and the neighbor's firing off a rifle, you know, to have 12 suspects that quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty impressive. And they act pretty fast. I mean,
what is it impressive, or are they... are they using the term suspect loosely and saying?
Yeah, I think they might be doing that just slightly too. You got to remember, the whole community's probably a little up in an uproar right then, right? I mean, so they're probably trying to keep people calm. Like, look, we've got some suspects. We're working it. I mean, they even talk about, you know, when we were looking into this, that the flashlight they found, you know, they shipped that off, you know, and I don't know how long back in that day it took to get to the FBI in Washington, but they ship it off, you know, to have it analyzed.
Pony Express.
Express, yeah.
I don't know how long it took. So you mentioned 12 suspects, but they boiled it down to 3 that they kept for extensive questioning. So I think they were bringing a lot of people in, but they were weeding them out somewhat quickly. And then whoever they couldn't weed out, they were keeping them for, you know, further questioning. But the other thing is they've got 47 officers working on this thing around the clock.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot.
From 4 different counties.
And again, nothing was stolen. So I think their thought process is that I think they call it a sex maniac.
Well, and I think when you say, I think the Starks must have had some money in the house that was not taken.
Yeah, and I think they said that she had some jewelry, some nice jewelry that nobody lifted when, you know, if they wanted it, it was there easily for the taking.
Right. You know, they'd already killed the husband. The wife's fled. They could have taken that much time probably to find something of value to take. So they're ruling out robbery. I mean, back to your point, their best guess is some type of what they're calling sex maniac back in those days. Well, and to that point, you know, they didn't even take Katie's purse, right? That was left at the house. But that becomes the front page of the Sunday edition. And it big letters, it says sex maniac hunted and murders. Okay. So we're trying not to scare people.
Yeah.
But yeah, Let's put out that there's a sex maniac running around. Well, there's somebody running around killing people anyway. One of the things they did, Gibbs, which I have to believe was pretty advanced back then. They actually had a mobile radio station sent from Austin, Texas. They equipped the cars with 2-way radios.
Yeah. They equipped 10 cars with this so that way they could communicate much faster to each other and back to the main office.
Right. So, I mean, one thing you cannot say is that they were not trying and pulling out all the stops. right, to try to find this killer, which they had to do. Like you said, the whole area of Texarkana had to be in lockdown panic mode at this point. So it was about 6 days after the incident on a Thursday that they got back the results of the flashlight that they had sent off for testing, and it was found that it contained no fingerprints whatsoever. It was about 20 days later that the Texarkana Gazette ran a front page color picture of this flashlight. And basically it said, "Have you seen this two cell flashlight?" With a whole story about, you know, this is a detailed picture of the flashlight found at the scene of the Starks murder. It's a two cell, all metal, painted red. I mean, they were very descriptive, but plus they had a picture. And the thought was that this was not something that you would find everywhere, right? A limited number of these had been sold around the area. And the paper was basically saying, if you have owned or you know anybody that does own one of these, you got to report it to the sheriff's office. So, I mean, this is probably one of their best clues that they're working off of at this point.
It's even around this time that, you know, the different police departments to get together and they make a joint statement in the newspaper, right? Just again, telling everybody, if you, on the dates of all the murders, if you know anybody that would typically be around that wasn't around, if you know anybody that you thought were missing, if you know anybody that seems suspicious, basically covering everything. Bottom line is, if you know any detail, no matter how small, come forward, tell us, and allow us to decipher if it's important or not. So they're reaching out, right? They're trying everything at this point, because to me, it sounds like everything's headed pretty cold. The leads are all cold. They don't know anything about the flashlight. They don't know anything about the casings. All the blood work comes back, nothing to tell them who it is.
But I will say they're big on technology, right? So they got the two-way radios, and then they bring in a teletype from Austin, and they install that in the Bowie County Sheriff's Office, and they've got that up and running. And basically, it said that, you know, it would allow them, again, to connect easily with other law enforcement offices in Texas. Now, one of the things we haven't talked about is reward money. They issued a reward kind of almost after each of the killings. We did talk about the $500, right? They started with that.
Yeah, we did.
What we didn't say is they were adding to it.
Yeah, it kept on growing to 3 to 5 right. to 7.
And basically what they said, you know, after Virgil was killed was that if it turned out that the same person was responsible for all the murders, all the rewards would be combined. And at this point, it's $10,000.
Which is a lot of money back then.
Yeah, you want to do your famous math conversion?
It's like
currency conversion?
$78,000 today.
What do you mean? Way more than that.
No.
All right, Gibbs. So I think that's where we have to end part one. You know, we've gotten through all the murders. And what we'll be looking forward to in part two coming out next week will be a lot more rumors. We'll be talking about all the suspects, rabbit holes, all the stuff we like to get into. I mean, the suspects are going to be very interesting.
I can't believe you're going to make people wait a week.
Yeah, we don't do it often, but
yeah,
little teaser.
I tried, folks.
That was just too much, man. There's no way.
I know. Yeah, it definitely way too much. So
there's a lot of good stuff that's going to be in part two. Because yeah. The suspects are fascinating to me. All right, so that's it for Mike.
And Gibby.
Stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store, but did you know Shopify powers selling in person too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in-line and online. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/truecrime.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Let's face it, sometimes multitasking can be overwhelming, like when your favorite podcast is playing and the person next to you is talking and your car fan is blasting, all while you're trying to find the perfect parking spot. But then again, sometimes multitasking is easy, like quoting with Progressive Insurance. They do the hard work of comparing rates so you can find a great rate that works for you, even if it's not with them. Give their nifty comparison tool a try, and you might just find getting the rate and coverage you need is easy. All you need to do is visit Progressive's website to get a quote with all the coverages you want, like comprehensive and collision coverage or personal injury protection. Then you'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies all lined up and ready to compare, so it's simple to choose the rate and coverages you like. Press play on comparing auto rates. Quote at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.